From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how reform to Wisconsin's expungement law could make the difference for jobless people in the Milwaukee area.
It's a very big issue among unemployed people. And at a time when unemployment is so low, it's down to around 3%, we're looking for ways to reduce barriers that exist.
Later, a look at the ongoing work of the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery Project.
Milwaukee's Pride Fest offers local LGBTQ artists a chance to show off the creativity of the community.
It's also a good way to network and align yourself with other artists. So many people spend their time trying to compete with each other. I don't think people take the time out to try to see what they could accomplish if they actually work together.
And Milwaukee Magazine's Carol Nixon shares the magazine's annual City Guide issue and offers her top 10 list of summer activities around town. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We've reported extensively on the issue of mass incarceration and how it impacts the Milwaukee area. But the criminal records of more than a million Wisconsinites impact their lives even after they've served their sentences. Having a conviction prevents many people from being able to get a job.
But the legal expungement of a criminal record could make a significant difference in employability for many Wisconsinites. So why isn't it used more often? The Wisconsin Policy Forum explored how expungement works in this state and how Wisconsin's use of it differs from other states around the country. The result is a just-released report, and senior researcher Joe Pietrangelo joins us to share what he learned. He explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke what we're talking about when we use the term expungement.
Expungement is the ability to clear a criminal record or to seal it from public access without a court order. So it's a way to be able to move on from a past criminal conviction.
It doesn't mean that the conviction never existed, though.
Right. It's sort of treated as if it never happened when it's expunged. The file still exists, but it is not allowed for public access. And also that applies to the web, because now a lot of the court records are accessed on the web.
Well, and so what sorts of cases are eligible for expungement typically?
So in Wisconsin, it is lower level crime. So it started off, it was only misdemeanors. It did expand in 2009 to include low level nonviolent felonies. It's limited in its scope.
One of the issues, though, that comes up in this report is non-convictions, dismissed charges, and acquittals. Why are those part of a criminal case record at all?
It's a good question. It's always been that way in Wisconsin. The case is still recorded, and there's still access to it even online if the case was dismissed or ended up in an acquittal. It's actually very unusual. If you look around the country, other places tend to remove those from and don't allow public access to them.
So why is this an important time to be exploring this issue, especially in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we looked at this issue really from a workforce angle because we've done a lot of past research on barriers to employment and had seen in looking at Milwaukee County participants of workforce programs that a large percentage of them have criminal records. It was 42% of the 8 or 9,000 individuals we looked at in Milwaukee County. So it's a very big issue among unemployed people. And at a time when unemployment is so low, it's down to around 3%. We're looking for ways to reduce barriers that exist.
Is there any way to figure out exactly how many people are disqualified from jobs because of a criminal record?
I can't quite go that far. Like I said, there is 1.4 million people in Wisconsin that are estimated to have a criminal record. And when I saw the 42% in the Milwaukee County job seeker pool, that was a lot higher than I expected. Certainly a very common issue statewide.
So while you can't draw a direct correlation, it stands to figure that some percentage of these people who are unemployed and who have a criminal record are unemployed because they have a criminal record.
Right, and Wisconsin does have non-discrimination laws, and so there are things in place to prevent people from being discriminated against. However, it still tends to be a barrier to getting a job.
Well, and you mentioned that there are people in the system who, you know, are there because of but had their charges dismissed or are acquitted. Are there people who are not employable just because they're in the system in general?
For a non-conviction,
yeah.
You mean? That's a good question. I think that a lot of this stuff is hard to know. It's just, you know, individual employers going online, checking the WCCA website, which is the website that lists all of the conviction records and non-conviction records. So really, it's hard to know exactly what factors are at play when they're making their decisions.
You mentioned that Wisconsin's expungement law is somewhat unusual at a national scale. So what are the ways that it differs from elsewhere? How do these laws work in other states compared to here?
Yeah, and that was a key part of our study, was really comparing us to other states. And we found one unusual thing in Wisconsin is that the decision is made by the judge at the sentencing hearing, and that's when it has to be made. It's the only time it can be made.
They decide whether a case could be expunged?
Exactly. They say, okay, this case, if you complete your sentence successfully, it will be expunged. That's when the decision is made, or they may decide you're not eligible. But you can't come back later after you've completed your sentence and say, you know, I've completed my sentence, I'm ready to move on, and can I clear this? That's not something that is possible currently. Whereas in most states, in fact, all other states, as far as we can tell, it happens after the fact, after the person has completed their sentence.
Other ways that the law differs from other states?
Yeah, other ways are Wisconsin imposes an age restriction. So the crime had to have been committed when the person was under the age of 25. So that's pretty unusual nationally as well. There are a few other states that have age restrictions, but generally it doesn't matter how old you were at the time. Another factor is the non-convictions, which we talked about. And one more is the severity of cases. So in Wisconsin, as I said, you can have some very low-level nonviolent felonies expunged. In other states, in some other states, they're more broadly allowing felonies to be expunged of most types.
Now, when you started this work, you were initially looking at expungement as it pertains to Milwaukee County, correct?
Yeah, because like I said, it came out of our past research on barriers to employment here in Milwaukee. But as we looked into this issue and found that really the state law is what controls most of how this works in the state and in Milwaukee, we expanded it to really have a statewide focus. We did still look at data on Milwaukee County cases, Milwaukee being the largest county and having the most criminal records. We still felt that was relevant, but in terms of where possible changes could be considered, they'd mostly be at the state level.
So given how stringent Wisconsin's expungement law is, how often are cases being expunged in the states?
Well, we didn't specifically look into expungements that had occurred, but other research has done that. The Badger Institute, another research organization, has found that around 100 cases per year are expunged in Milwaukee County and around 2,000 statewide per year.
Well, and so presumably as you looked into how the existing law is applied, you looked at, you know, changes to the existing law. What sorts of changes did you explore, and what would be the upshot of those changes?
Yeah, so one thing we looked at was what if Wisconsin allowed judges to make the decisions after sentences were completed? Now, we can't really say that would change the number of cases necessarily, but going forward, an individual could come after completing their sentence and petition for expungement, and then the decision would be made then, as it is in every other state. The advantage of that, or judges often feel that they can't really make that decision at sentencing. It's sort of like looking into a crystal ball. We heard that a lot in interviews we did. You know, it's just hard to make that call before the person has gone through their sentence. So that's one change. Another change would be to not only have the decision be made afterwards, but allow people to go back and request expungement of past cases that have been closed. So that would actually be a really large change that would potentially increase the number of eligible cases dramatically by thousands of cases.
That would add some significant administrative cost as well.
Right, and we looked at that. That's definitely a caution in the report, or something that would be a challenge, is that if there's a huge influx of new cases, it could have a lot of workload and fiscal impacts on local governments. But it partly depends on how the law would be structured. It could be that a lot of these cases could be decided without having to have hearings. So if that's the case, then it could have less impact on the courts.
Well, so in general, is there still some concern about what expungement would do in terms of allowing access to criminal records when criminal records might be relevant?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a balance there where the public wants access to be able to see whether somebody has committed a crime in the past, but then on the other hand, there's the privacy of the ex-offender and the ability for them to be able to move on at some point from that conviction. So that's really where there is a balance between different interests and goals.
But presumably that's where the discretion of the judicial system would come in.
Potentially, yes. That's part of the issue in Wisconsin. There is a lot of discretion, and that is a positive in terms of allowing flexibility, allowing judges to make decisions based on the complexity of an individual case. But it also leads to a lot of disparities, perhaps, in how it's applied and lack of consistency across the state.
What sort of appetite was there for changes to the expungement law?
Well, interestingly, in 2017, both the state Senate and state assembly considered and approved their own versions of reform to the expungement law, and they passed overwhelmingly on both sides, but they had differences, and those differences weren't resolved. In both cases, they would have shifted the decision-making to after sentence completion. But from there, they kind of diverged in terms of what changes they were considering.
So were there other potential changes that you examined?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the age restriction is very unusual here in Wisconsin, and that would be another potentially large change. If people of any age could petition for expungement, it could be, we found hundreds of cases per year in Milwaukee County likely would be eligible. In addition, the other changes I mentioned in terms of the severity or allowing non-convictions to be expunged would have smaller impacts. Those would, but they would, also add additional cases potentially.
Joe Pietrangelo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with Mitch Teich, and you can go to our website to find a link to the forum's report. It's called A Fresh Start, Wisconsin's Atypical Expungement Law and Options for Reform.
We'll take a short break and then look at some of the work coming from the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery Project. That comes your way when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee County's Poor Farm Cemetery was the final resting place for thousands of Milwaukeeans who died in the late 19th century into the mid-20th century. They were people who often couldn't afford a burial. Some were estranged from friends and family, and some were immigrants who came to Wisconsin looking for a new life.
For the past few decades, archaeologists have been working to learn more about these people through the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery Project. Over the years, they've learned more about who these people were, how they lived, and how they ultimately died.
Patricia Richards is the director of the project, and she joins us now in studio. Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
So just to start here, what is the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery?
The cemetery is actually one of four cemeteries on the Milwaukee County grounds in Wauwatosa, and this is a cemetery that was used officially from 1882 through 1974 for the burial of the community poor of Milwaukee County, for the burial of individuals who died as a resident of one of the institutions on the county grounds, for the burial of individuals who were unidentified or unclaimed from the coroner's office. So it was a varied group of people who were interred in this particular set of cemeteries.
So 1974, that's actually pretty late.
Yes, absolutely. It was in 1974 Milwaukee County got out of the business of providing burials for the poor and began contracting with private funeral homes at that point. But yeah, 1974.
So when we're thinking about the earlier burials, mm-hmm. The burials around, you know, the 1880s, who mm-hmm. were a lot of these people?
In the 1880s, it was an interesting group of people, most of them immigrants, of course, reflecting the city of Milwaukee and the county of Milwaukee and that particular population. Many of them, most of them, I would have to say at that point, were middle-aged men without other kinds of resources. And many of them were folks like today who just sort of slipped through the cracks of having family or other kinds of institutions to support them. And that was the population that was buried out there at that point.
So tell me a bit about your work with the Poor Farm Cemetery.
I began working at the cemetery in 1991. In 1991 and 1992, there were a set of excavations related to construction of Milwaukee County Ambulatory Care Center on the county grounds. And at that point, they disturbed a cemetery in the summer, August of 1991. And I was involved in those excavations for 2 years, at which point I then did my dissertation research on that set of excavations and then went on to do other things and then ended up back at UWM. And in 2008, that collection, which had been housed at Marquette, was permanently transferred to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And I got involved again, and we basically began what was called the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery Project. And then in 2013, Frederick Hospital was also involved in a expansion project where they requested permission to disturb, and we again excavated on the county grounds at that particular location. So I've been involved for a very long time, since the 90s, in this particular project since 2008, and really culminating in those 2013 excavations.
So, yeah, you've been involved in these excavations. Mm-hmm. What does that process look like?
Okay. In Wisconsin, all human burials are protected by law, and consequently, there is a set of procedures that one follows if one wants to, if there is either an inadvertent discovery of a cemetery or if one wants to disturb a cemetery. And that process involves asking the State Historical Society for permission to disturb and then contracting with an archaeologist who is a qualified burial excavation and an analyst, archaeologist, and the Historical Society maintains that list. And then a plan is written to deal with the particular circumstances of a cemetery. And so then the excavation is allowed to begin. And then beyond just the excavation, that state law requires that an analysis and a reporting be done of that as well. So essentially our excavation involved identifying the areas that were going to be disturbed in 2013. Stripping those areas off prior to the excavation with machinery, large machinery, identifying burial locations, and then hand excavation of each individual burial. That excavation involved not just the removal, but the documentation of all of the material goods that were with that individual, the documentation of the position within the coffin, and then the removal, and then ultimately removal back to UWM for analysis, and then ultimately reporting.
So you're analyzing not just the burial itself, where people were buried, but the people who were there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that my students and I are very clear on in our heads and tell the tale often is that when one is granted the privilege of excavating human remains, one has then the need to recognize the humanity of those individuals and to really try to tell an individual story as well. And those kinds of analyses allow us, the kinds that we participate in, allow us then to say, this is an individual whose bones and whose material culture, the things that are found with them, tell us that they were this age, that they may have been interested in these kinds of things, that they suffered from these kinds of diseases, that they may have broken a bone at some point in their lives, that they died as a very young individual or they died as a very old individual. So those are the sorts of things that we look at when we try to understand the burial itself. And then we augment that with a rigorous program of historical documentation. So we do a lot of contemporary primary document searches. We look at newspapers. We look at all of the records that are associated with the institution grounds, which are increasingly found at the Milwaukee County Historical Society, which has been great for us. So we look at those kinds of documents as well, and then anything else that we can find that is associated with those individuals. We really are interested in trying to identify individuals. What has happened with the cemeteries on the county grounds is that the land gets repurposed. And each time the land is repurposed, there is an institutional memory that goes away about how the land was used before. And that happens particularly with these cemetery areas. So by the time we get to them, there's no markers, there's no map. There's a list of individuals who purportedly were buried out there by year, which is complete in some years and not so complete in other years. So we know who's likely to have been buried there, and we know who we have when we've excavated, but we've made attempts to link those two things up. And we've done so since the late 90s. We've done so for over 200, close to 300 individuals, just because we can look at things like the osteological record, things like the material culture record, and then the historical documentation.
Are you able to identify most people?
No. Out of the 2,480 individuals that we have excavated, we only have about 300 that we're pretty confident. But it's an ongoing process. And I have a number of students who are working on that using a number of different kinds of techniques.
Of the 300 that you have identified, mm-hmm. Are there some similarities there? Is there a reason that you were able to identify them versus the other people?
Yeah, I have a student who just finished her PhD, Dr. Drew, and one of the things that she argues is that we can look at what she has called in her dissertation linchpin individuals, that is, individuals who are unique. So I mentioned before that most of the adults are males, overwhelming number of the adults are males. So we focused on looking at females and hoping that their distribution and the things that we could say about females, how old they were when they died, what they may have died as a result of injury or disease, those kinds of things we could match up with the documentation. And we've had a little bit better luck. We have some interesting individuals. So, for example, an individual who died from an injury on the county grounds, a head injury, and his skull was trepanated to relieve the pressure in the skull. And we were able to find that individual and link the name to that individual. There's a most famously, I think, in some ways, is an individual, and again, this was Dr. Drew and myself looking at the records and finding a record for someone who was buried at the county grounds by the name of Gertrude West. And we were just, because we were looking for females, and we're looking through the records, and we found Gertrude, and we're reading through this, and at the time, we were looking for a teenage girl, I think. And then Brooke said, oh, no, this individual's too old. She's in her 30s, but she weighed 640 pounds. And she was a carnival performer. And I happen to remember there was a particular coffin that was very unique, that was very, very large, that was reinforced. And we managed to put those things together. We managed to find the material culture associated with this individual. She had a wedding ring. She was married to to another circus performer. She died of she actually died of septicemia related to a mosquito bite. All these kinds of things allowed us to put all these things together. So we were able to identify Gertrude as well, because she was a very different sort of individual. As a result of that, knowing where Gertrude West was buried, we could work out from her coffin, and we've identified a number of other individuals related to her based on the physical spacing. So it's very rewarding, absolutely. It gets a little discouraging after a while.
What do we learn about the past and about how people lived when we look at these excavations, when you look at these excavations?
Mm-hmm. There are a number of things. First of all, one of the most remarkable things, I think, about this particular group is that they are like many other groups. So they may have been marginalized, but they worked hard. They clearly had a need. They had the drive to come here as immigrants. They did the best they could with what they had. They clearly involved themselves in looking for jobs, trying to find jobs, trying to do whatever it was that they needed to do to get by. So we learn a lot about the resiliency, I think, even though people say to me, well, how can you say that these people were buried? Well, that's true of virtually everyone eventually. Isn't it depressing? And it is in some ways, but it's also a reminder of the human spirit, I think, in many ways, and the remarkable way in which humans cope, I think. So we learn a lot about that.
Is there anything new on the horizon for your work?
Yeah, we have a couple very interesting projects right now. I have at least two students now who are interested in looking at dental calculus. And that may seem very odd, and I kind of get that response a lot of times. But one of the interesting things about dental calculus is that it's a record of not just what someone has eaten throughout their lifetime, but the sorts of things that they have been exposed to. And the two students are interested in the ability to synthesize DNA of various diseases from calculus. And so I've got two students looking at that, one of whom is very interested in TB. The other one is interested just in the human microbiome and looking at diseases in general. So this is one of the things that's going to help us look at a number of diseases like TB, when it was lethal, when it wasn't lethal, what kinds of people seem to be more susceptible versus those that weren't. So those kinds of things are really exciting. I also have another student who's working on imaging and looking at things like gait and the ability to understand a person's lifestyle from their bones. And she's doing it by 3D imaging the bones and then using computer simulation to look at gait and articulations. And then several other students, particularly one of the things I didn't mention is about a third of them, maybe not quite a third of them, are actually what we refer to as neonates, newborns, or stillborns. And it's a huge, huge number of individuals that are represented in that age group on the county grounds, which, again, is reflective of the time. And one of the individuals who's working on this project right now is looking at health and also looking at how to assess health both prenatally and postnatally, looking at these remains of young individuals. So lots of really pretty exciting stuff going on.
Important work?
We certainly believe that. To do the work we do, we have to think it's very important. Yeah, it may be less. It may not be dinner time conversation, as my children are fond of pointing out, but we feel very strongly about it. Yeah, we're very, very, very close to the work that we do.
All right. Well, Patricia, thank you so much for joining me here in studio and speaking with me about your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
Patricia Richards is the director of the Milwaukee County Poor Farm Cemetery Project. She's also a senior scientist at the Department of Anthropology at UW-Milwaukee.
Pride Fest starts today. After a break, we'll meet the person in charge of booking the talent for the women's stages and a Milwaukee musician making her Pride Fest debut. Lake Effect returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect returns now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers.
Walking the line and hoping matches the layout. I've been pushing the limits, so mama say I should pray now.
That tune called Blow is by Milwaukee hip-hop and R&B artist Kiwi. She's been performing here for a number of years now, but this weekend she makes her debut on the Pride Fest Women's Spot stage.
Sarah Tybring is the manager of the stages, and they both join me in the studio now. Sarah and Kiwi, welcome to Lake Effect. It is great to have you both here today.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
So am I. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And we're going to get to your song in a minute, Kiwi, but Sarah, I want to start first of all with why you're both here. I mean, this is the beginning of Pride Fest. It kicks off the festival season in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But you have a very specific role in Pride Fest. So what is it that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the manager of the Women's Spot stages. This will be my fourth year running those stages. And it's a stage whose goal is to seek out and promote women artistry and non-binary artistry throughout the local area. We go a little bit further than Milwaukee. We do get artists from around Wisconsin and occasionally into Illinois and Ohio who find us and come to perform on our stage. We have 3 days to promote artists from all genres of music and also other types of art, including we do poetry, we do a comedy showcase, we do this year we have a trans workshop that's about self-care, and then we also have circus and other performance artistry, so we have a circus that's going to be performing with us in the front of the stage.
How fun!
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's an honor to be able to do it.
So when you think about Pride Fest, you know, I think a lot of people automatically think of men. Mm-hmm. They automatically think of drag performing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so I think women have often gotten pushed off into the corner. Is it kind of your mission to make sure that doesn't happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's really important to show that there is a vast array of talent within our LGBTQ community and a greater just female-oriented community. I think that it's really necessary to show that they have an essential niche in offering art. And I also think that it's very important to show that female artistry in the LGBT community isn't just folk music, which I think is a very common thought process that lesbian music is folk art. It is that, but it's also tons of other things. We have rock artists. We have hip-hop artists. We have phenomenal poets. We have people who do physical art, and that those are things that should be seen and should be given a stage and should be promoted just as heavily as any other form of artistry or gender.
So, Kiwi, this is your first time, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
So how did you two connect? Did she reach out to you? Did you reach out to her?
Well, honestly, we've been playing like maybe this game of cat and mouse for the last couple of years where we've connected like a long time ago. But generally, because I'm kind of stubborn in a sense, and I would lose my head if it wasn't attached to my body, I kind of like this year just got on top of it, like I'm going to commit to it, I'm going to do it. It's definitely a great experience, and Sarah's awesome. So, I mean, she makes it really easy for you to feel comfortable to provide what you need as an artist. But, you know, when she presented it to me, you know, the pitch she brought was that whole, you know, being a forefront, or bringing to the forefront the spectrum of what being an LGBT artist is. I know a lot of the times, because I do hip-hop, because I do hip-hop specifically, sometimes people think that I have to be a certain thing, or my music sounds a certain way, or the things that I talk about are generally within this not very broad range of anything. So I always tell people I'm more of a lifestyle artist than a genre artist. And I think Sarah understands that, which is what I greatly appreciate. And it's just a good opportunity to not only display the creativity and the diversity within the LGBT community, but it's also a good way to network and align yourself with other artists and other opportunities in the future. So many people spend their time trying to compete with each other. I don't think people take the time out to try to see what they could accomplish if they actually work together. So this is one of those opportunities I'm really proud to be a part of.
Now, you're from here, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So as an LGBT artist, mm-hmm. do you find that it helps or hinders you outside of Pride Fest?
A little bit of both, if I'm being honest. It helps because it makes it easier for me to get put on a ticket with a lot of guys in a male-dominated industry because of what they think my music is, or what they think the context is, or the content, or because they look at me and they think one thing and I get to bring something refreshing to it all the time. But it also hinders me because it limits what I'm capable of doing when I want to expand out of hip-hop, if I want to do something more mainstream, more involved, some outside of that, it kind of makes it a little bit difficult, not just to get on the ticket, but dealing with other people who have these predetermined notions or judgments of what they think my motives may be, or, you know, things like that. So in a sense, it does help. I have a little bit. I've been doing this for a while, so my reputation helps, too.
But yeah, everyone has to build that.
Yeah. It took me years to do that. So, I mean, I got a good leg up on that aspect of it. But it's still challenging, you know. I work on it every day, you know, trying to see past it, trying to see the benefit of what I can bring to it, you know, if there's not an opportunity or if there's not something that somebody wants to, you know, work with me on, then there's somebody else that has another opportunity that might fit better for me, you know. So if I can get one opportunity, I can get another one. There's always going to be an opportunity, and I'll just take advantage of whichever ones that come my way.
You just have to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, or put yourself there.
Yeah, you have to put yourself in the right spaces. You also have to know how to move around in multiple spaces. Most people get stuck comfortably just being around that one group of people that they're used to working with. And I used to be like that when I first started, and that hindered me more than actually me being LGBT. You know, it was because I was uncomfortable getting outside and working with different people that could expose me to different things or have different resources that may be beneficial for me in the long run. I was so comfortable within that group of people that I was working with that I didn't see the benefit of reaching out and branching off and networking. I didn't understand the value of my network at that time, which I've come a long way.
So. Yeah, and I was going to say, Sarah, is that something you're also hoping that other artists on the stages will do, like get out of their comfort zone and reach out and maybe find collaborators or just be exposed to other things?
Yes, absolutely. I think that one of the big benefits of doing this is the recognition that we have to work together as a community in order to raise each other up. And I think that hip-hop especially is a community where that needs improvement, especially among female artistry. And I get that feedback every year from artists in my hip-hop showcases. And they have met each other, and they work together now. I have several members that continue to work together. They pull each other on tickets. They do collaborations outside of Pride Fest as a result. And I think that that's exceptionally important to do. And I think also it's really fun to watch people be exposed to different things. For example, last year I had two artists that performed similar time frames. And at the end of the night, we caught them in the bathroom singing to each other in harmony. And this is Alice Hart and Katie Beth. And they're amazing vocalists. And so this year, what I said to them was, I would like to have you back, but I would really like it if you do a duet act together because you are so phenomenal and you clearly were just having like the most fun you could ever have. And if you don't mind me putting you together on a ticket, I think that that should happen. Of course, they were super thrilled and they're going to do it. But it's really fun to be able to watch people commune together. And I love to preach about all kinds of fun things. And one of the things I say to all the performers when I'm sending them out all their information is, please remember to support each other. Please remember to promote each other. Please remember to invite everyone to all of the events because everyone deserves this shot. Everyone deserves this recognition. And we're all doing the same thing in a different way. And if we stand together, we can do anything we want to do. There's no reason why we can't. There's so much talent and so much passion, so many good humans involved in this production. And then outside of that, the reaches are just insane how far we can go if we do those things. So
one of the things that I think is so interesting about any of the festivals that have a specific focus, whether it's Pride Fest or German Fest or Irish Fest, you know, you're obviously preaching to the choir. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking to your tribe, whatever mm-hmm. that tribe happens to be. But you also have the opportunity to speak to people who are not in your tribe. You have a chance to reach people who might not hear you otherwise, or like you were saying, Kiwi, might have an idea of who you are by how you identify. So they think, well, I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
But then they hear you and they go, oh, wait a minute. You know, now is that also something that you both hope for in your own ways?
Yeah. That's always what you hope for, no matter if it's, you know, somebody who doesn't necessarily listen to hip hop music or if it's somebody who doesn't necessarily think they have anything relatable to LGBTQ artists or somebody who just generally doesn't get around a lot of sociable people like that or they don't think you have anything for them. So it's always refreshing to see how your music has an effect on people and how they respond to it, especially when it's positive. You know, there's not really many negative reactions to my music that I could think of at all. They've all been genuinely positive experiences for people that I appreciate at the end of the day, because all that work I put into trying to get on a ticket, it actually pays off because somebody gets something out of it. And that's the goal when people listen to your music. You want them to be able to relate to it, to take something from it, to understand at least you or where you're coming from. So,
well, and the tune that you sent me, Blow,
yes,
is wonderful. It's
Thank
a wonderfully catchy tune.
Thank you.
There's so many different elements going on. It's very melodic. It's very rhythmic. It's all kinds of different things. And I can hear all of your influences in that one song.
That's
or at least many of your influences,
yes.
Anyway. Bit about it. What made you write it? What was the impetus?
I work a lot. Sarah can tell you that. I work like a madman. Because I put all of my money goes into my music. I'm a firm believer. If you don't invest in yourself, nobody else will want to invest in you. So I was at work one day, you know, working a job I hate years ago, and I was mopping the floor, and this producer sent me a beat like, "Think you'll like this," you know. It was slow, so I had nothing to do. So I'm listening to the beat in my headphones, and all I kept saying, thinking, was that first part that comes on the beginning. You know, your heart's not there, and you caught right there. You shouldn't be staying if your heart's not there. And I was like, this kind of goes to the beat, you know? So I was mopping the floor, and then everything just came to me. Like, essentially the melody, what I wanted the hook to be, you know, what I wanted it to be about is just about being free, free from the things that tie you down, free from those things that may deter you or prevent you from chasing your dreams or even trying, because, I mean, failure at the end of the day is still a success in my eyes. Some people don't even attempt to do anything, and that's essentially a failure to me. At least from a failure, you can learn, and you can adjust, and you can move forward. So it's just about being free from the things that prevent us from being ourselves, prevent us from attaching ourselves to each other and learning from each other's experiences and pain and joy and everything.
Well, I can't thank both of you enough for making time to come in. I know things are getting crazy because we're so close to the start of the festival, but I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. At some
point, I would love to have you come in and perform.
Of course.
Let's do that. Let's stay in touch with that. And Sarah, thanks for all the work.
Thank you.
And thanks for talking about it.
Very happy to do so.
Milwaukee hip-hop and R&B artist Kiwi makes her Pride Fest debut Saturday evening on the Women's Spot stage. Sarah Tybring is the manager of that stage, and you can find more information about all of the artists and musicians performing at Pride Fest at WUWM.com.
Pride Fest kicks off our summer festival season, but there is even more to enjoy over the next few months. We'll learn more when we explore Milwaukee Magazine's City Guide. That's next on Lake Effect.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. There is a lot of pressure on Milwaukeeans to take advantage of our fleeting summer weather when it exists. In fact, sometimes it can be overwhelming to try to figure out how to pass a summer weekend. And it is for that reason that Milwaukee Magazine's City Guide exists.
The annual issue features dates, places, and events on the summer schedule and includes some summer activities that might not have been on your radar until now. It's on newsstands now, and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke talked with editor and publisher Carol Nixon about her top 10 highlights for the summer ahead.
Just a little bit about our city guide. It's one of the readers' favorite issues of the year. It stays on the newsstand for 3 months, the full summer. And it really, we try to make it, you know, your go-to guide for everything that's cool and fun in Milwaukee in the summer.
And some of these things are great reminders for those of us, you know, it's been 12 years that I've lived here. And there are probably some things that I knew about already and have forgotten about, and still some things that I did not know about at all. So let's dive right in. I don't know what order you have these in, but we should start with number 10 and count our way down to your favorite thing to do in the summer.
Okay. Number 10 on my list for this year, get invited to both the University Club and the Wisconsin Club suburban locations so I can compare and contrast their pools. And that's, you know, if you want to invite me, you know where to find me.
Well, and once again, this is one of those things I didn't entirely know about. I had not realized either of those had suburban locations.
There you go. So, yes, they do. And I haven't been part of the loop yet, but I hope to make it this year.
So, University Club and Wisconsin Club, you are on notice. Number 9.
Okay. I want to do the Bastille Day run the same way that Millie Strawn does. So Millie Strawn was someone that our writer interviewed, and Millie really takes a laissez-faire approach to it. There's a lot of drinking and not much running and a lot of socializing, and it just sounded like, okay, I can do that.
The Bastille Day run is always a part of, obviously, it kicks off Bastille Days, the storming of the Bastille, and always one of the highlights of summer for a lot of people.
Okay. But I didn't know I could do it without running.
So that was number 9. Number 8.
So I wrote a little piece about how much I enjoyed last year having a beer at the Tiki Bar on Bradford Beach after playing tennis. And I really want to relive that moment. It was a great moment. And talk about, you know, a cheap thrill. I don't know how much the beer is, but the view and the moon was rising. And, oh, my goodness, it was just the best.
Maybe you could pair it up with your Bastille Day run.
It's going to be a boozy summer. I'm just telling you right now.
All right. Number 7.
I want to try lawn bowling.
And this is a huge deal in Milwaukee.
Apparently.
As huge as lawn bowling can be.
Yes, exactly. It has limits. But in Lake Park, there's this lawn bowling association, and it sounds a little like bocce.
It's a very summery, kind of relaxing, I don't want to say it's meditative, because I suspect there are a lot of people who are pretty hardcore about it, but it could be a meditative activity.
I would think so. And plus, they wear these, you know, white outfits.
I was going to say, you have the pants for it right now.
I'm halfway there.
So that was lawn bowling, number 7. Mm-hmm. What is number 6 on your list?
Oh, I haven't experienced Chill on the Hill yet.
Really?
Yes. So, you know, I mean, this is my third summer here, and there's still plenty to explore, and that's one of the things that I haven't done yet.
So you could potentially join the many, many people who make Chill on the Hill one of their favorite summertime activities.
Yes. Do you go?
I will admit I have not done it yet either.
Mitch, we could do it together.
We could.
Let's do it.
All right. That was number 6. We're down to your top 5.
Yes. Similar to Chill on the Hill, there's so many festivals that I have not explored yet, and so I want to add another one to my roster of visits. I'm thinking maybe Indian Fest?
Right. India Fest is August 18th. Actually, that was one of the most interesting things that I recall from this city guide is some of the ethnic festivals that are off the beaten path.
Yes.
You write about Croatian Fest.
Which I've been to, and I'm half Croatian. It's wonderful, but you have to get there in time to have the lamb, because the lamb is the thing.
And that goes on in Franklin. Mm-hmm. And then there's Armenian Fest, which is July 22nd at St. John the Baptist Armenian Orthodox Church. There's Puerto Rican Family Festival, which is August 5th, and as you say, India Fest.
Yes. So India Fest is at Humboldt Park, and I've been to India. I love the food. I love the culture. It's on the list.
All right. Some additional festivals are your number 5.
Yes.
What is number 4 on your list?
Okay. On a very hot day, I plan to go to the lobby of the Pfister Hotel and enjoy a cocktail while reading Edith Wharton.
And why Edith Wharton specifically?
The ambiance of the Pfister. I want to link my reading material to the cocktail, to the space. So I looked it up, and there apparently is an Age of Innocence cocktail. It's gin, Lillet, creme de violette, and chartreuse. And it was described as delicate on the outside, but pure booze under the surface. That's the end of the booze. It's not.
Sounds like
that
a metaphor for something.
Yes.
All right, number three.
I love the farmers markets, and I go to the one in Cathedral Square a lot, and I go to the one in Bayview a lot. But I want to explore some new ones. And one of the things that I have friends who've done this, and I've not done it, is to just go to the market. Buy a lot of stuff that you're unfamiliar with, a lot of vegetables that seem a little bit, exotic, and then figure out what you're going to do with them. So that's part of the plan.
Give them to your coworkers.
No. After I cook them in some exotic recipe.
So was that number three? That was number three,
yes.
Right? Number two.
I want to visit the Highway 18 Outdoor Theater, otherwise known as a drive-in.
the dying breed that is a drive-in movie theater. Remind me, where in the Milwaukee area is that?
I think it's on the way to Madison. I think it's about, halfway between here and Madison. When I was a younger person, I used to go to an outdoor theater in Newark, New Jersey, that was very close to the airport. So while you watch the movies, the planes came in and took off overhead.
So that was number two. And your number one goal for this summer in Milwaukee?
Da, 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 da. Leave room for surprises.
I think that's always good advice. Before we started this recording, you were hoping that I might share a couple of things that I am especially looking forward to over the summer of 2018. And I'll say my tastes tend to be pretty simple. I really enjoy two things about the summer. One is getting out on a kayak on hopefully the Milwaukee River. I've done that a couple of years. I've done kayaking around, some of the lakes in the area. I love to do that.
That's one of my favorites, too. I'd like to do it during my lunch hour.
I would love to do it during my lunch hour also. And, mm-hmm. Our office here is right on the Milwaukee River, and yours is not far from the river either, but it would be a great way to kind of unwind at lunch.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention the hashtag ReadLocal?
I do. So as part of our redesign, we added a little hashtag, and you'll see it right over the barcode on the cover, and it's hashtag ReadLocal. And it's just, a little reminder that just like it's a great thing to shop local and to eat local, it's also important to read local and to support your local media, not just us, the newspaper, the business journal, all of the local media, because without local media, how do you know what's going on? That's
right.
All.
The New York Times is not doing a Milwaukee City guide.
No, they aren't. They aren't. They
With
should.
All due respect. Carol, I will continue to read local, and thanks so much for sharing the city guide. Have a great summer.
Thank you, Mitch, and I'll continue to listen local.
Carol Nixon is publisher and editor of Milwaukee Magazine. She talked with Mitch Tyke. The magazine's annual City Guide issue is on newsstands now and will be here through the summer. You can find a link to more from WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.